Okay, we can go back now to item number 9. That is our Washington's Reptiles and Amphibians briefing. Lisa Halleck, hello. And Mark Hayes. Now, Lisa's with biologist with the wildlife program, and Mark is a scientist with the habitat program. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director. All right, so we are here to give you an update on Washington's amphibians and reptiles. There we go. And just to acquaint you with the talk, we're going to start with the publication on amphibian declines that inspired this invitation, give you a little bit of background on that. Go over the reason the declines are happening, the reason it matters, and then what we're doing in Washington. So the paper was called Trends in Amphibian Occupancy in the United States, and it came out just this year. And it was the first ever estimate of how fast frogs and salamanders are disappearing from their habitats in the United States. And it was a big study. It was based on 9 years of data from 34 sites spanning 48 species. And what they found is that frogs and salamanders are disappearing at an alarming rate from their habitats. And it's not just rare species, it's also the species we would consider fairly common. And it's occurring throughout the United States, including on lands that we consider fairly protected. So why is this happening? And some of this we just have to look around. When you do this to the landscape, this is Green Lake in Seattle, and you add all these people, then you're probably not going to have a lot of these species like western toads and western pond turtles. So it's also what we do to our habitats or our yards that's hard on them. Roads in particular, a lot of the amphibians move in large numbers to their breeding sites and away, and so they're killed in large numbers. And even our pets, especially our cats, can be problematic. Even in places where we don't have so many people, we still have issues. This is the Columbia Basin, and everything in blue has been converted to agriculture. So the only native shrub stuff that's left is indicated in yellow and orange. The good news is that a small species like the Great Basin spadefoot can persist in these small patches. The problem is, if anything happens to that patch, they don't necessarily do well in agricultural lands. It kind of depends on what those lands are like, and they're too small to move across those large expanses of agriculture. So even within those patches, we have some issues. This is native shrub steppe in the Vantage area, and this is where our rarest snake, the striped whip snake, lives. This is a visual hunter. They actually move through the habitat with their head raised, looking for their main prey species. At this site, it's side blotch lizards, and they need that bare soil between the shrubs that you can see there in order to do that. Problem is, in a lot of places in the shrub steppe, it now looks like this because we have invasive species like cheatgrass that grow so densely that the habitat isn't suitable for these species anymore. So that's what we can kind of see just looking around, and we shouldn't be surprised that declines are occurring when we see that. For the amphibians, though, something else is happening, and that the paper highlights in the fact that these declines were occurring even on our national parks and wildlife refuges in places that we consider not really having some of the impacts that I just showed. So the authors didn't speculate on why this is happening, but certainly others have. Emerging diseases, I'm sure you've all heard of amphibian chytrid virus that's devastating populations in some parts of the world. We have increasing pollutants, we have decreasing ozone, and we also have climate change. So those are some of the ideas on why these populations may be declining, even where they're relatively protected. So then the next question is, why does it matter? And I'll start with the biology. These species are ecologically important. They are efficient at biomass conversion. They're important for providing food. Many things eat them. They are important for transferring nutrients, so because they move between wetland systems and terrestrial systems, they transfer nutrients. Important for controlling insect populations, the frogs, salamanders, and larval salamanders are all insectivores, all eat insects. And in the case of the tadpoles, while many are grazers, some also filter algae out of the water, and that helps keep the water clean. One of the reasons that we don't always appreciate how important they are is that we're unaware of how common they can be when they're doing well. And that has a lot to do with their small size, where they live. They're often secretive under leaf litter, in logs underground, in water, and also they're nocturnal, so we tend not to see them. But when they're doing well, they can be very abundant. And there was a study done in the 1970s in New Hampshire where they sent a whole bunch of students out to study plots, and they collected as many salamanders as they could find. And what they found is that the biomass of those salamanders was twice that of birds during the breeding season and about equal to the biomass of the small mammals. So, and interestingly, one species made up about over 90% of that biomass. And just so you know, it's not a huge salamander. It would fit in your hand. So, some other things. I'm sure you've all heard amphibians are biological indicators of environmental health. That has to do with a couple different things to do with their biology. One, they go through metamorphosis. So if there's contaminants present, there's a second opportunity for developmental problems to occur. And also it has to do with the way they're exposed to their environment. So I have some egg masses up here. That's red-legged frog and northwestern salamander. And those fill with water from the environment. So right away, the embryos are exposed to the water and any contaminants that might be there. And then another reason is amphibian skin. And as you can clearly see, they don't have feathers or fur. So they're in direct contact with soil and water. There's no barrier there. And that's important for these species. They use their skin differently. They breathe through their skin. And so it has to be moist all the time. And they keep it moist by being in contact with moist surfaces or in water. And they also drink through their skin. And so they, again, need to be right next to the soil in order to absorb that moisture. So all of those things make them very much exposed if contaminants are present. So that then takes me their skin to their importance in human medicine. Because they're so in contact with soil and water, they would be very prone to bacterial and fungal infections. As a defense against that, their skin is one of the richest sources of antimicrobial and antifungal peptides, and researchers are looking at those as a way to develop new antibiotics for humans. So, on a lighter note, people like them. I would say that's especially true of the frogs, and children seem to be particularly attracted to them. And people notice when frogs are gone, and that, of course, is because they are the sounds of our spring nights and our summer nights, and so when people stop hearing them call, they're aware of it and give us a call. Okay, so what's the situation in Washington? We have 25 amphibian species and 21 reptile species. We're doing pretty well, except in the category of turtles. We only have 2 turtle species. In terms of species with federal or state status, the Oregon spotted frog was just recently proposed as a federally threatened species. It's also a state endangered species, along with the northern leopard frog and the western pond turtle. We also have one state-sensitive species, and that's the larch mountain salamander. And this is a salamander that lives in specific rocky habitats. It's very patchy on the landscape. And right now, we believe we can manage them just by identifying where they occur and protecting that habitat. So that's what we do for that species. For our endangered species, we do a lot more, and I'm going to kind of walk you through what we're doing right now for our 3 endangered species. So the Oregon spotted frog is a very aquatic species. They rarely ever leave the water. We have both a status report and a draft recovery plan. And for this species, we are still doing both inventory and monitoring, so we're still looking for new populations. Up until 3 years ago, we thought they only occurred in three watersheds in Washington. And then with funding through U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and access to private property, we were able to find three new watersheds where the species occurs. And we are hoping that with continued funding and access to these private lands that we'll be able to find more occurrences. We've done lots of research since the 90s when the species was first listed. Put a bunch of logos up there to show our partners. Most of our work has been looking at their biology and their habitat needs, but we are also looking at genetics, behavioral ecology, and so forth. As you'll see, for all of these endangered species, habitat management's a very important part of what we do. This is a photo showing folks out looking for Oregon spotted frog egg masses. And this species lays in very shallow water with short grass and full sun exposure. And this is also the same place that reed canary grass, an invasive species, does very well. And it can look like that in the breeding areas if we don't have maintenance of those areas, and that's not suitable for the frog. So we're doing all kinds of different things. We have sites where we have cut and cover, so they put out barrier cloth to kill the reed canary grass and then replant it with native vegetation. Grazing is an important component at many of our sites for keeping the grass short. And we also do mowing at some of our sites so that the grass is short in the spring when they breed. We have lots of partners in this work. These agencies and groups own the lands where the frogs are, do a lot of the management for the frogs, have helped us get lands when that was an opportunity, and even prepare lands for reintroduction of the frogs. And we do have one reintroduction project. When we're out doing the monitoring of the egg masses, we collect eggs, take them to our partners at the zoos and the Sustainability in Prisons Project, and they raise them until they go through metamorphosis, and then we release them on Joint Base Lewis-McChord. And the biologists at Joint Base Lewis-McChord are our partners on this project, both in doing the monitoring and also in the habitat work. All right, so our next species is the northern leopard frog. This is actually our rarest frog species in Washington, but they have a wide distribution, so they don't have the federal attention that the Oregon spotted frog has. In Washington at this time, we can only find them, or we only think that they occur now in the Potholes Reservoir study or reservoir area. We do have a status report for this species, and next year we're going to be writing a recovery plan, or I'm sorry, a reintroduction plan. For this species, we do monitoring. We haven't figured out a great way to monitor them yet to figure out the size of their population. They're hard for us to find, but we can find the newly metamorphosed frogs, and that's what you see here. The green dots are the places where they were able to find them this year, so that's good. It tells us where the frogs are. But we're still looking for a better way to try to figure out how many frogs are out there. We've done some research with our partners at Central Washington University looking at amphibian chytrid fungus. The frogs do have it, and we're not quite sure what that means for the population. We've also done habitat work to try to figure out what the frogs need. And this is them working to figure out what the frogs are doing during the winter. And Washington State University has been looking at individual frogs to figure out if the patterns are stable enough and unique enough that we can identify individuals without any other type of marking. The habitat work we do at this site has a lot to do with tall emergent vegetation. It becomes too dense in these isolated ponds for the frogs, and so we try to set that back. There's also been work building some berms so that when the reservoirs are at high water, fish don't get into these isolated ponds, and fish are a problem for the species. We did attempt a captive breeding program with Washington State University. They started with 50 tadpoles, and they had great success. They grew those to adults. They got them to breed, but then they got hit with amphibian chytrid fungus, and they ended up losing the entire breeding population. So we have another opportunity to work with Columbia National Wildlife Refuge. They used to have the frogs and would like to have them again. And this time we think we're going to work with the zoos and hope that their ability is better to deal with the disease issue. The Western Pond Turtle. This is quite a story. At the start of recovery in the 1990s, we were down to two populations of less than 200 turtles, and we only had 12 turtles left from South Puget Sound. As of today, we have six populations, and over 2,000 turtles have been released. We have both a status report and a recovery plan for this species. And last year, about 30 experts on pond turtles met together, and we produced a population and habitat viability assessment. And that involved providing a lot of information on populations so that they could model how many we need on the landscape, what percentages we need to survive in order to help guide our recovery. We also looked at habitat needs, and also the husbandry folks from the zoo were there, and they also provided a section in this document. We do monitoring for this species, which involves a lot of trapping. For some sites, we're determining population size, and then at other sites, we also try to catch adult females and track them to their nesting sites. So you can see that down below. When we find those nesting sites, depending on the location, we either take the eggs immediately into the zoos for head starting, or we put an exclosure on them to protect them from nest predators. And then come back in the fall and take the turtles into Head Start, or at some sites we leave the turtles in place. We just protect them until they hatch. And the reason we Head Start them is that in the 1990s, when we were at our lowest point, we couldn't find any evidence of recruitment. In other words, it looked like all the hatchlings were being lost, and we thought that was to predation, probably bullfrogs and fish. And so the idea is to grow them bigger so that when they go out into the environment, they won't be eaten by those predators, and we can kind of get ahead in terms of the population numbers. The habitat work we do for this species has a lot to do with where they nest, and we have problems with invasive Himalayan blackberry. And so you can see the work crews here. We've worked with prison crews and also volunteer junior youth crews on various projects to keep the nesting areas clear. That's what it looks like when they're done. Also building basking enhancement, something that's very important for the species. As you can see, they all want to be on the log. And also removal of bullfrogs, again, because they can eat the small hatchlings. Our Head Start program has been going for about 20 years at the Woodland Park Zoo and Oregon Zoo. You can see they start very small. They keep them for about 10 months. And at that point, they're the size of three-year-old wild turtles. And we measure and weigh them and notch them and then set them free at the recovery sites. And our turtle releases are a big deal. We try to get lots of young people there. We use them as an educational opportunity. As you can see down in the corner, there's lots of media there. And so this is a good opportunity to let the public know what we're doing for the species. Have run into a little bit of a problem recently with disease. This is the second time we've had a disease in these turtles. The last time was a respiratory disease. This time it's in their shells, and you can see it causes the shell to rot away or deteriorate. We're not quite sure what we're dealing with yet. We hope to know in the next year or two, but we have lots of partners helping us try to figure this out. And we have even more partners that I wanted to mention that own the lands where the turtles are, do a lot of the habitat work, have provided funding for our work. So that's what we do specifically for those species, but it's also important to have outreach. And so for the last few years, we've produced a threatened and endangered wildlife document, which you are all getting today. This provides a short summary of everything that's happening with these species, and it's available online to the public. So I also mentioned that we have many other species beyond these that are listed, and so we want to keep the common species common and the declining species from declining any further, and so we need lots of tools to do that. And one of the things we have is the Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Strategy, and as part of that, we go through and we identify the species of greatest conservation need. And there are 11 amphibian species and 8 reptile species, and that includes the listed species that I just went through. And they're on this list for a variety of different reasons. Some have a limited distribution in Washington, naturally. The California mountain kingsnake is interesting. You can see the area where it occurs down in the gorge. It occurs along about 21 miles, and then there's not another population of them for 200 miles to the south in Oregon. So... Then we have some species that are, like the western toad, that are actually still fairly common on the landscape, but have disappeared from entire areas of the state, like South Puget Sound and the lower Columbia. So we're watching that species, we're concerned about it. And so the connectivity working group has done some modeling to look at their habitat needs and connectivity to try to figure out how to keep these on the landscape, keep them from declining. And that's beneficial not only to the toad, but to the other suite of amphibians that occur with it. And then we have some species that have declined to the point where a status report is being considered, such as the striped whipsnake, that we now, through a bunch of inventory work and other work, have determined they probably only occur in 2 areas, although we're hoping to find more. And we are already working with our partners at Department of Natural Resources and the Natural Area Program to help protect the occurrence where they are. So lots of work, and we can't do it all by ourselves, and so we're really looking at partnerships for research and conservation, and one of the big ones, of course, is citizen science. And the photo you see here is volunteers for Woodland Park Zoo, and we cooperated, we worked together with them. They had over 80 volunteers working in King County, Snohomish County, and Spokane County, and went out and did a whole bunch of amphibian surveys looking for the species, that's a red-legged frog egg mass, like that are easy to find, and to provide us information about what they were finding on the landscape. And we hope to keep expanding our partnerships with those projects. We have some tools for outreach for volunteers, like the Washington Herp Atlas, and this is available online. It has information on all the reptile and amphibian species, information to help the public identify species, and also we provide distribution maps, which are generated directly from our own database, so the public can see where we knew these species used to be, where we know they currently are, and we can ask them to submit more information so we better understand the distribution of these species. And something we're just starting to dabble in that's much more common in the East and Midwest is how to deal with large numbers of losses of these animals on roads. And so in the East, they have these volunteer groups that go out at night and close roads or move the animals across roads. We're looking at maybe some of these culverts or things that go underneath the road. So we're just starting to go there now. And I'm now going to hand this over to Mark Hayes with the Habitat Program, who does landscape-level research, trying to figure out how we can still do forestry and keep our amphibians common on the landscape.
Thank you, Lisa, Commissioners, and Director. The Habitat Program has been involved in significant landscape-level research under the Cooperative Monitoring Evaluation and Research Committee, which is the adaptive management arm of the Forest and Fish. For those of you that are unfamiliar with the Forest and Fish Agreement, it is unique, probably in North America, in being an adaptive management science agreement where science really drives policy. Many stakeholders are involved, ranging from state and federal agencies, the tribes, environmental caucus, and major private timber companies. And it represents an agreement that covers an HEP that is the largest in North America, 9.6 million acres of managed forest lands. That agreement addresses basically 4 goals, which are to maintain harvestable populations of fish, water quality, the viability of a number of concerned species, which include 7 target in-stream breeding amphibians, and of course the economic viability of the timber industry. And there are a number of studies that have been done under the auspices of Forest and Fish, but I'm only going to highlight one study in particular, which is their flagship study that we call the Type N Experimental Buffer Treatment Study, which was really designed to evaluate the effectiveness of the buffer prescription for non-fish-bearing streams in western Washington. One of the unique aspects of the Forest and Fish Agreement is that it moved into non-fish-bearing streams prior to 2000. There was no prescription for non-fish-bearing streams. It addressed only fish-bearing streams. And the foci of this study cover a wide range of things, ranging from water quality to riparian stand characteristics, but I'm talking about it here in context of how it addresses these in-stream amphibians. And the study itself has a large landscape range in which a series of four treatments were applied. One of those treatments is the standard buffer prescription that was agreed to under the Forest and Fish Agreement, which is on the lower left. And in addition, there were two treatments, one more severe, a 0% buffer with equipment exclusion zones, which is on the lower right, and a 100% buffer, which has a two-sided 50-foot buffer along the entire stream length. And then the fourth treatment was what we call reference or control sites that were sites that were historically in the harvest rotation but were kept out of treatment for comparison to the other treatment sites. Now, we are in the seventh year of work in this study, and I can't tell you the details yet because we are involved in writing a 19-chapter report that covers all the aspects of it, but I can tell you that the stakeholder scientists that originally agreed to the agreement made a very good guess, because it looks like the results of this study suggest that the forest and fish buffer prescription is successful in protecting resources, including the seven target species of amphibians. This study involved extensive field data handling and reporting work. There are nine co-principal investigators, and we had field crews annually of 10 to 21 individuals doing the work, the hands-on work. Funding came from both state and federal sources through the Cooperative Monitoring, Evaluation, and Research Committee. And I want to emphasize the partnership in this. We had many partners and collaborators, collaborators and landowners. The collaborators ranged from the Washington Department of Ecology, major private timber companies, Weyerhaeuser and Longview Fiber. Weyerhaeuser in particular, whose statisticians were particularly helpful in assisting in design, ourselves, the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, and Washington State University, which was involved in genetic aspects of the study. The landowners were critical to this study because they're the ones that actually implemented the treatments at the various study sites based on the design that was set up by the various collaborators. And what we hope that we've done is given you an introduction to the amphibians and reptiles in Washington State. And although there have been a whole variety of efforts to protect and conserve these species, it's very clear that we need more information in a whole variety of areas. Amphibians and reptiles tend to be sort of the ugly stepchildren to a lot of other wildlife, and we need information in particular on their life history and status, habitat changes, climate change, and a variety of other factors such as disease. And we try to go forward with engaging as many partners as possible, ranging from government, private landowners, professional and university-level researchers, and most importantly, citizen science efforts, which are critical in situations to do landscape-level things that we couldn't do otherwise. And, of course, outreach and education is critical if we're to convince people of the importance of this group of wildlife. Thank you. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is that a smiling salamander?
That's what they look like.
That's great. Really fabulous. Very informative. Commissioner Keeney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Very good presentation. Opens our eyes, I think. I think there was a paper put out by the Washington Cattlemen's Association recently on the Oregon spotted frog, and I read it, and I was kind of encouraged, and I thought, and I actually went and talked to them about it, and, you know, to where possibly that, you know, it was certain species anyway, that some of the management that we do out there, whether it's farming or ranching, could actually be beneficial for some of the species. And so they were talking about, you know, the mowing of the grass, the grazing, that for the Oregon spotted frog, for instance, you know, just even the hoof prints in the wet dirt could leave little shallow depressions of water. The irrigation canals or the ditches, as well as the tailwater ditches, you know, could possibly be beneficial for that particular species. So that was encouraging to me, and I think I heard that in your presentation. So maybe you could mention that a little bit.
Yeah, grazing is one of the different ways that the habitat is, and on those private lands where we're finding them, those are all grazed lands. So it is, because we have such problems with reed canary grass and the way it grows, there has to be some type of management in place to keep that. And probably historically, flooding and beaver, other things kept that habitat that way, and there perhaps wasn't as much reed canary grass. But yes, today, at many of our sites, we depend on grazing.
Commissioner Schmidt?
I didn't know I had my hand up, but I will take advantage of it.
Oh, I thought you did.
Lisa and Mark, thank you very much. Wow. Not only was that educational, that was like reading a National Geographic magazine article. Interesting.
Only better.
Even exciting. And if your goal was to get me or the other commissioners to go out and want to do something, I think you achieved your goal. That was exceedingly interesting. Thank you.
Commissioner Smith?
I'll second that as well. The citizen science aspect, this is a logical. I mean, this, you know, it's scalable. It's something that I think, especially in the K-12 realm. And you mentioned the Woodland Park Zoo, and I think that's a great partner. And I'm sure you're reaching out to lots of other potential partners. But I think that, you know, I think that's something that we could do in the department as well, just to help you develop that list of who, whether it's the National Science Teachers Association mm-hmm. branch in Washington State or 4-H. I mean, it goes on and on. So I just think this would be a really great project for them. It would hopefully get kids outdoors more, too. You know, a lot of other spinoffs that could come out of that. So I would be happy to brainstorm with you, as I'm sure my colleagues would as well. And I do this partially out of great guilt because as a child.
Here we go. There's always
here
a confession.
We go.
This was, well, I'll blame this. This was in Ontario, so it's my fault. But I used to use leopard frogs for smallmouth bass. It worked.
Which is why we're trying to keep those fish out of those isolated ponds, as you well know. Yeah.
Commissioner Keeney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have guilt, too.
I know.
I can tell somebody. I used to frog hunt in Nebraska and have frog leg fries. But now I do have a question because I live on the Okanagan River, and when the water comes up every spring, mm-hmm. we have lots of ponds form. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, where do they all come from? You know, where were they before all the water came up? Because there's just this chorus. It's beautiful. It's the wonderfulest sound in the world to hear all the frogs, you know, for about 2 weeks at least. And I'm thinking, well, were they all in the ground, or were they all in the forest, or, you know, I mean, just a technical question.
Yeah, it kind of depends on the species. So you would have, if you could make the sound, I could help you a little bit in knowing what frog you have there.
Give it a go.
Is it just a ribbit, or is it kind of like a snoring sound?
It's a ribbit.
Okay.
I won't make it, but you can't even hear yourself think it's so loud.
Okay, so those are probably our Pacific tree frogs, or people call them chorus frogs. And they might be living in the riparian areas. They can move somewhat terrestrially. They don't move very far from water. If you have talus in the area, sometimes they can go into the talus during the day and then come out at night. So,
and then are they done after 3 weeks? Is it their breeding season and they've laid that they had the eggs and tadpoles, and then they're done. They don't make any more noise.
That's it. So they've That was what they needed to do. They needed to call in all the females and reproduce. So, yeah, it's just the males that are calling, and that's it. So the tadpoles, of course, would still be there. And then the frogs disperse away from the well. In some places, you must still be able to find them on the shorelines if you were to.
It's pretty rare, and it's all pasture ground. It's not
okay.
And then there's a riparian area, but I didn't know. I go down there, and they all shut up.
Yes. Perhaps I should come and look. I could do a survey for you, let you know what's going on.
Let me add that you're welcome to hunt frogs as long as they're bullfrogs.
Yes, the bullfrogs.
They were in Nebraska, sure.
They're good eating.
Okay, Director Anderson.
Thanks, Lisa and Mark. You know, what I find difficult is for the members of the general public, or maybe more specifically our traditional constituents, to have an appreciation and understanding about what the Department of Fish and Wildlife does as it relates to biodiversity and tracking species such as these that you've heard about today. And I think that there is a large segment of the state population that really values this type of work and has a real appreciation for diversity in populations of wildlife. And I just keep trying to think and work with folks trying to think of ways that we can make the public aware of this really great work that's being done here and how it goes toward the betterment of the quality of life in Washington. And I haven't come up with the solution to that yet, but I think people like Lisa and Mark and others that are in our diversity division, our diversity, and our public outreach and education folks, we need to put a finer point on the work that we do here to maintain biodiversity within our habitats, because this is really important stuff, and these critters can really tell us how we're doing. And as you can see, we're not doing very well in a number of places, but these are the kinds of animals that are really worth saving. They're difficult to save, but they're worth saving, and the more people have an appreciation of them, the more public support we'll get for our efforts for things like this, and including the citizen science pieces. So thanks for doing this. And thanks, Commissioner Jennings, for making this request.
Chair, that was a point I was going to make, too. This actually presentation was asked by Dave Jennings, and who continued to educate us about appreciation for non-consumptive uses of our wildlife. And David, thank you. This is just excellent.
And the importance of the personalized license plate, that those PLP is a critical component of our funding stream that allows us to do this work. And I don't know how many people really realize that. They want a personalized license plate, some of them just because they want to say something. But the value that it brings to wildlife diversity is not well understood.
Commissioner Smith, do you have something else?
No.
Okay.
I was just signaling David.
Yeah, good job. Yeah, terrific. And one avenue, I would say, for influencing the perspective of the general population is youth. The youth are open-minded. Okay. Thanks so much. It really was entertaining and informative and terrific.
The report that's online, you said that you were going to Did you say you had one for us?
I will hand them out.
Oh, you got them back there. Okay, great. Thank you.
I will hand them out.
Do you have one for David, too?
I do. Right.
And the offer to help was sincere. So
yeah. Okay. Yeah, I wrote it down.
And I won't use them for bait.
Okay. Thanks so much. We have reached the point of recess over an hour early. It's excellent. So we can have a long evening to talk and relax and have dinner. And we return at 8:30 tomorrow morning for a short session tomorrow morning. Okay. So enjoy.